NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. I think we've got an interesting show because it's going to be the Todd show today. You've been following these UASs, UAVs, unidentified flying objects, whatever you want to call it. You've been following these reports and actually been filing FOIA requests of the FAA and getting some interesting responses. So. Indeed. Without getting into your thunder, John, do you want to add anything before we turn Todd loose?
No, only that this is damn interesting stuff, and it just defies description.
Yep.
I always thought these things were, you know, these reports were not accurate, but I'm changing my mind.
Well, I'm glad that you had that teaser, John, because I couldn't have written a better one myself, but I'm going to go back in history for a little bit. Why the heck am I involved in this? I mean, after all, like the two of you, I'm seriously involved in aviation safety. I've been going through aviation safety events and data for years. And, you know, like everybody else, I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and all the other, you know, flying saucer movies growing up. But here's the thing that got me. 4 years ago, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence had a report on UAP, which is the government's term for you know, what we used to call UFOs, unidentified anomalous phenomena. They had a line in their report that said, UAP are both an aviation safety issue and a potential national security issue. And I thought, you know, I'd never seen a government department say that about UAP. Now, what are UAP? Won't go into details, but basically it could be anything from, in my opinion, a straight-up flying saucer to just something that's in the sky you can't identify. That can even be some natural phenomena. And in fact, you know, I'm going to flash a few pictures during the show here, one of which is from a presentation I'm preparing that talks about a natural event that used to be so controversial that if a pilot reported seeing it, that person would be grounded. These are things called jets and sprites. Basically, it's an electrical discharge that goes from the top of a thunderstorm up in the lower reaches of space. The picture I'm showing you is from a shot taken by a NASA astronaut on the ISS in July of 2025. Beautiful shot of it, and it's been understood for decades that these things existed. But in the 50s and 60s, when you had your high-flying pilots, military pilots, seeing things that were not mission-critical and reporting them, that can get you grounded. Well, fast forward to today, you still have a whole lot of resistance of reporting things that just don't make any sense because public ridicule and whatnot. But one of the things that about that is the FAA is slowly coming around to dealing with this as an aviation safety issue, but not fast enough. They don't even have an official protocol for how do you deal with seeing something unusual like this. By the way, most of them are identified as aircraft later on, or identified as natural phenomena, or just simply unidentified because they don't fall into a category.
Let me just stop you right there. If they get recategorized after they've been reported and they go, oh, yeah, it was an aircraft, then why aren't they showing up on radar?
Well, this particular one we're going to talk about today, they didn't show up on radar. And you see, you guys are, what's the word for it? You're giving spoilers here. I'll just go through one personal story. Yeah, everybody's heard of Starlink satellites. Well, when they first launch, you have like 20, 25, 30 of them coming out at once. And if you ever see them like a day or two after they come out of the rocket, they're going across the sky like a line of aircraft at high altitude. You see like 20 or 30 of these white dots real close to each other. It's like, I've never seen anything like this before. It's like, what the heck is that? Is that a spaceship? Literally, it is. They're satellites. You hit it right at the right time after sunset. You can see them in clear as day. And there's some satellites that look like airplanes. International Space Station's been up for like 20 years or so, 20, 25, whatever the case is. If you see it under the right conditions, it looks like an airliner. It's a bright white light. It goes across the sky about as fast as an airliner goes. If you didn't know it was coming, you were driving down the road or walking down the street to say, oh, that's a jet. No, it's a spaceship. But let's go to the case we have here. Back in November, December last year, there's a whole lot of stuff on the East Coast about drones in New York, drones in New Jersey, doing all kinds of crazy things. Well, it turns out there is a drone database of the FAA. Remember how I said the FAA doesn't have an official way of reporting things? But sometimes they get reported with another name on it. So I'm thinking, if it's a UAP, but it kind of looks like a drone, maybe it's in the drone database. So I'm looking through the database for December of last year, New York and New Jersey. Didn't see anything that was really unusual. But in between New York and New Jersey is the state of New Mexico. There was an event in New Mexico. I just happened to glance at it because it was right there in the spreadsheet. And it was basically a 767 was flying west over New Mexico, heading to LA, and it said it saw 25 UAS, UAS's unmanned aircraft system, which is the FAA speak for drones, in all directions. They're like cruising at 34,000 feet. My first thought was, there shouldn't be anything at 34,000 feet that's a drone that's unidentified, because that's controlled airspace. You can't just go fly willy-nilly up in there if you feel like it. You have to be under an IFR flight plan. You have to be in contact with air traffic control. You have to have a transponder radio, the whole nine yards. These things didn't. And I thought, okay, maybe they mistook flares or lights on the ground or satellites. No, they said these things followed them along for an hour. And given the time of night, it was too late to be a satellite because the sun is already set a couple hours earlier. No light to reflect off of anything in space. Plus, satellites don't follow you for an hour, especially going from east to west, because most satellites are either going north and south or they're going from west to east because they're taking advantage of the Earth's rotation. So it's like, this doesn't make any sense. So I did a bunch of FOIA reports about this because I thought, if the military did this, they would have warned people because it's dangerous to fly in controlled airspace like that. Well, Greg, let me ask you. You have flown above flight level 180, which is the area where everyone has to be on an IFR flight plan. There are very specific requirements for the aircraft. There are very specific requirements for the pilots. The pilot in command has to be qualified to fly IFR. Now, what would you say would happen to you if you decided, for the heck of it, take your airplane up to 25,000 feet? You're flying safely. You're using whatever tools you can to avoid people, but you don't talk to air traffic control. You don't have a transponder. Okay, you're shaking your head. Why? You're afraid you're going to lose your license?
I'm afraid I'm going to lose my life. When you're up there, again, it's a well-choreographed dance up in that's Class A airspace. So you have to be in two-way radio communication. Of course, you're being tracked. And we have 1,000-foot separation minima for traffic. I wouldn't want to play in that game without knowing where all the traffic is and being at an assigned altitude that I know no one else is at least coming head on to me. So, when you got airline pilots that are up there and you have multiple pilots. So it's not like I see it. I wouldn't say, hey, Todd, what do you think that is? You can just keep it to myself. So if I'm seeing something out the window, I'd go, Todd, what does that look like to you? And then if there's 25 of them, it's like somebody took the time to count them. So they had to have been in a position to be visible to these folks for some period of time, like you said, an hour. They were able to count them. And then, you know, you said that the FAA doesn't really have an official database, if you will. But they do have those MOR reports, those mandatory reporting, whatever. I forgot the official term.
Occurrence report.
Yeah, occurrence report. When you got guys that are willing to put their name on it and be identified going, hey, this is what we saw, you know, they're not Looney Tune because you now have multiple people seeing the same thing. It's one thing, like you said, years ago, yeah, they'd check you over and bring you in and ask you to look at this, you know, ink blot and tell me what it looks like kind of thing. But now, you know, they're actually taking this stuff seriously. And when you think about it, John, I mean, I practice religion and, you know, there are things that go beyond all human understanding. I believe in that. And I also believe that we, in all the many universes that exist, not just the one that we live in, but the many universes, I find it very difficult that we are the only living organism that can actually think and talk at the same time. So, you know, you start thinking about, is there this other life? The other thing that I think about, Todd, is when you look at some of the creations from eons, thousands of years ago, where, you know, you look at the pyramids. Who the hell dreamed up how they were going to put those big rocks, stack them in a particular order so that they don't fall down? It's very well choreographed. It took thousands of men or people to move. Who came up? I mean, that's a higher level of architectural thinking. You don't just learn that overnight, especially if there's no books. So who taught the first guy to go, you know what, we should build these pyramids? And this is what it's going to look like, and this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it.
Now, this is a situation not as complex as the pyramids, but something that if people dreamed it up, it would be pretty easy to dream up. It's like, let's, for the heck of it, take a bunch of aircraft, whether with people on it or without people on it, and fly it in Class A airspace, see what happens. Now, this is over the Southwest U.S., and maybe military organizations might do this, or contractors who are trying to get a military contract, they're trying to get an edge on the competition. It's like, let's test this out. A lot of military ranges, both off the coast and on overland, from my experience, you know, in flight testing the military, it would be insane for any commander or any civilian organization to pull a stunt like this for whatever reason. That is, without any authorization from the FAA, and more spoiler alert, the reports I got from the FAA stated that there were no authorized UAS activities going on around this airplane. Now, let me get back to the story before I get too far ahead of myself. I sent in a bunch of FOIA reports, Freedom of Information Act requests, to ask for specific things, like the ADS-B track from this Delta airliner, like any reports sent back and forth across the government. And it was only after I sent the first bunch, I looked at that same database again for other events around that same time. Turns out, like 2 hours later, over Palm Springs, a different airliner, this one at 26,000 feet, I think, rather than 34,000, reported 25 UAS. I thought, okay, this is nuts. The first one I'd never seen before. And to have something very similar 2 hours later, something's up. Now, let's fast forward 5 months. Why 5 months? Excuse me. This is August. 6 months. It took me 6 months, basically, to get response from the FAA. They gave me four items. One was the ADS-B of the first airliner. Another was a daily log overseeing, you know, overall log, special events that happened in the air traffic system that day across the country. That's written in such a high level, I got to get some air traffic control friends of mine to decipher it for me. But two things they gave me called mandatory occurrence reports. This is something not sent by the pilot. This is sent by the air traffic organization, the air traffic controllers and their management, if there are certain things that happen, like a near midair collision, etc. The first report from the Delta airliner was even crazier than the initial report I saw. It said not only that there were 25 of them, it said specifically, there are four of these each flashing a red and white light, that followed along with the airliner for an hour, roughly from the area just east of Santa Fe, New Mexico, over Prescott, Arizona. And they were like maneuvering around the aircraft, and one of them went under the aircraft as close as 1,000 feet. How they said it was 1,000 feet, I don't know. But what you had was five aircraft flying in formation, and one of those aircraft didn't want to be in formation. That's the airliner. And they're doing this for an hour. Now, the mandatory occurrence report said further, the pilots had sent a report via ACARS, which is a system that are in airliners to communicate with their ground folks, maintenance and whatnot. They sent an ACARS message to Delta. Someone at Delta Airlines on the ground contacted Air Traffic Control, Albuquerque Air Route Traffic Control Center specifically, about this. So now we're talking not one, not two, but three groups of people who are putting their reputations and their careers on the line if they were saying something that wasn't true. You have the people in the cockpit who did the initial report. You had their folks on the ground at Delta, and you have the people at the FAA. And before any government report comes out with the government's name on it, it has to be vetted. People have to say, yes, this happened. This is my true accounting of what occurred. Otherwise, you're talking about a conspiracy of three different groups of people who probably had never met each other before, doing something which, if they were like running a game on somebody or doing some sort of prank, it would end their careers.
John, you know, one of the things that when we were doing TWA 800, you know, somebody had suggested that maybe it was a UFO that had attacked TWA 800. You were intimately involved in that. I was down doing value jet, and I was just hearing some of this peripheral stuff. Whatever came of that?
They did an extensive looks for radar and the rest. And what it came down to, we even actually had a briefing on what you see from some, not just eye doctors, people that are way out there in research with what we see. And essentially, when they looked up, first off, that airplane's at 13,000 feet. It's 5 miles south of the shoreline of Long Island. So it's not, you wouldn't look straight up. So it's off at an angle, right? And it's 13,000 feet. So it's over 2 miles up. So you'd be hard pressed just to look at the red lights, the flashing lights. And what would draw your attention to it? There was a lot of people that claimed to see this. What would draw your attention? A noise or a bright light, a flash? We know that 5 miles before that the airplane hit the water, there was a stream of debris, pieces of the airplane that fell off. Many of them were on fire and smoking. And the people that did the vision testing for us said that it was pretty clear to them that what those people saw was not something going up to the airplane, but what they saw is pieces falling off the airplane that were smoking. So, because the flash drew their attention, but it already had happened. 5 miles back, it already had happened. And it wasn't an explosion initially. Right? I tell people, it's like if you've ever held a sneeze, you feel your body expand.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happened with this fuel tank. It expanded and broke the airplane. And then the air loads took care of the rest of it. The firebomb, the bright light came after the fuel tank itself had ruptured and spread out vaporizing fuel that ignited. And that was the flash that they all saw. But the event had already happened.
And it wasn't because of a UFO.
We were clear about that. We found the smoking gun.
Yeah.
It took $50 million to find it.
Yeah.
But we found it.
Yeah, because there was also reports of space junk that may have come down and struck the aircraft as well. And I remember the NTSB having to run that to ground to see what was in the area, what could have come out of the sky and everything else. I mean, it was chasing our tail. And so those are easier to dismiss. But when you have like Todd was talking about, two professional flight crew members, two sets of professional flight crew members reporting basically the same thing. And, you know, they have enough time to study it, count them, and then at least report it. Yeah, I mean,
in 2 hours apart, and they, neither one knew the other one reported it.
Yeah.
Well, let me interrupt there. The second aircraft might have been aware that something was up, because it, when I got the second report from the FAA, the mandatory occurrence report, it said, in essence, ACARS contacted FAA, FAA contacted the airplane, and they also told Los Angeles Center, which is the next center toward where this airplane was flying, about what was going on. LA Center had not a warning, but an advisory that was active for an hour or two after that. Now, the second aircraft reported this toward the end of that advisory period. Like I said, it was about 2 hours afterwards. Although the first report from the Drone Behaving Badly database, excuse me, I keep calling it that. It's the Drone Sightings Near Airport database. Look it up. I have it flash on the screen. They have quarterly reports, hundreds of them, of drones violating regulations, and some of them possibly not drones, but I'll get to that later. The mandatory occurrence report for the second one, well, let me go back to the first one. The first one said over an hour period, they saw 25. Four of them were traveling with them for an hour, traveling from the east to the west. The second report, the mandatory occurrence report, and let me just read verbatim what's there so I don't screw
up. Wait. If, okay, so the Delta flight was overflying New Mexico heading westbound. So
that's right.
They were, you had these unidentified objects following them at various points around the aircraft for an hour while they're flying east to west.
That's correct.
And what happened to them? What happened to those four?
That's unclear, because there's a gap between the Delta report and what happened with the United Airlines. But here's a key line from the mandatory operations report for the Delta aircraft. Delta Flight 771 stated four drones with red and white flashing lights had been following them for the past hour, flying around their wings, and closest proximity was about 1,000 feet below them. Okay, two or three things there. How dangerous is it for an airliner to have things flying that close to them at high altitude?
Well, I mean, typically when we scramble jets to go look at an airplane that's gone NARDO because of a pressurization problem, you know, I just worked one right now where they a couple of F-15s intercepted a Cessna Citation at 390. And the closest they got to observe the aircraft was 1,000 feet. And they had pretty good visibility on this airplane. So, I mean, you're 1,000 feet doing 500 knots. You know, that's too close for comfort. And if these guys, you know, for an airline pilot, it's just like they don't like airplanes that close. I mean, yeah, we do have 1,000-foot separations, but those are controlled separations. This is, you don't know what these things are going to do.
And typically when NORAD sends out two airplanes that are on alert, it's only two. They don't send out four. So the idea that this is NORAD intercepting an aircraft that wasn't in communication, they were in constant communication. Yeah. They were on track. They were not deviating from their assigned altitude, nothing like that. There was nothing that would attract the attention of NORAD to send jets after them. Now, keep in mind, east to west, four with red and white lights. The report from the other aircraft, the mandatory occurrence report said, the pilot reported red and white lights that passed close to them, slow moving, opposite direction, around the same altitude. Okay, a few things. If something's coming at you in the opposite direction, slow moving, maybe they were nearly stationary, they were going fast. Let's assume they had some idea of what their speed was. They said that they were going in the opposite direction, so they had some sense that they were traveling from west to east, not east to west. Let's assume that both aircraft were seeing the same, one or more from the same group of 25, which means you had at least four that were traveling as fast as the Delta airliner for about an hour. Who knows what the other 21 were doing? and a couple that were either hanging out ahead of the first group or had gone ahead, hung out for a while, and was coming back the other way. Either way, it doesn't make any sense. Red and white lights, for one thing. There should be some green lights in there somewhere because the standard configuration for an aircraft, even the smallest Cessna, like the kind I fly, you're going to have a red light on the right tip. Well, let me get this right.
No.
Left tip, and the green light on the right tip. Red, right, returning. If the airplane's coming at you, you'll see the red light to the right of center. But this wasn't one of those cases. They weren't coming. Well, one of them was coming at them slowly, close to them. I'm not sure how close, but too close for comfort, in my opinion. But let's back up a little bit. Nowhere in the reports do they say anything about UAP or flying saucer or what have you. I thought, okay, let's take them at their word. Let's say that these are indeed UAS, unmanned aircraft systems. And yes, that's FAA's definition. Not uncrewed, it's unmanned. We'll take an act of Congress to change that.
Unpersoned.
Unpersoned. How many UAS systems out there, how many drones are out there, commercial or military, that could fly as fast as an airliner and as high as an airliner? The answer, very, very few. Most of your commercial drones, including my tiny handheld DJI drone I have in the closet here, don't really get that much above 400 feet because legally, if you're Part 107, you can fly up to 400 feet above the ground in most cases. And certainly in extraordinary cases, you might be able to fly higher, but sort of like if you're flying around a building, you can fly over the top of the building. I don't know any 34,000-foot buildings.
The big thing here, Todd, is they had to be of sufficient size for the crew to recognize that they were something that, one, could fly as fast as them. Two, I mean, they don't say it was the red and white light combined or separated or whatever that might give some scale to whatever it was they were looking at. But even a drone, let's say it was something that the military, I mean, for it to move the way it's been described, where it's flying in formation and then circling around the aircraft. And while, yes, we know that airshow pilots do that with certain aerobatic maneuvers, the fact is moving 500 knots and sliding in and out, military pilots, I mean, again, it would be more of a prescribed procedure than the way it's been described, like you're talking about, through these Moore reports. So now, and then there's 25 of them. Where, like you said, where are the other 21? And then slow moving. So apparently they're able to fly fast or fly stationary, or at least slow down to the point of being relatively slow compared to the reporting aircraft. And I mean, these are phenomenons that, again, some of it may go beyond human understanding, if you know, because we don't know what they are. Nobody's taking claim to them. Apparently, they aren't picked up on radar, so we have no way of tracking where they came from or where they went. We don't know. I mean, there's no meteorological phenomenon that's going to create any kind of illusion like that, that I know of. And so the other thing is, you got four humans who are reporting the same thing 2 hours apart in two different parts of the sky. You know, I'm sure that they, unless they were on the same frequency, which I doubt, to overhear the Delta crew reporting it, you know, the United crew wouldn't have heard that earlier.
The Delta crew had already landed by the time the United crew had their sighting.
Yeah. So, you know, you start looking at, okay, what's the common denominator? Four pilots, 25 things flying around with red and white lights.
Now, let's say it's military. How many military drones do I know of that can fly that high and that fast? Two that came to mind immediately was the RQ-4, which is the Global Hawk, and there are variations of it. Basically, imagine the old U-2 aircraft without a pilot. Single engine, long straight wings, built for long duration flight. Not built for high-speed flight. To my knowledge, that can't keep up with a Delta airliner at cruise. There's also something I believe called the RQ-170, which is sort of like a Delta wing, kind of looks like a mini B-2. I don't know what the top speed of that was, but last I looked up, there were only about 20 or 30 of these ever produced. And again, I can't think of any reason in war or peace where the entire fleet's been in one place at one time for any reason.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
You know, there's a lot of confusion out there around the FAA requirements. Most people don't realize that the FAA requirements are the minimum standard.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's not the best. It's just the minimum.
And that's what we want to see. We don't necessarily say you have to do X, Y, and Z. We just want you to do more than the minimum required of you. Because obviously, the more you do, the better pilot you will be.
Great. And then, how are you received when you try to encourage pilots to go that extra step or go above and beyond? Are they resistant to it? Do they say, well, you know, I get enough training or I do enough flying, I don't need to do that?
Honestly, the majority of the pilots that we deal with are willing to go that extra mile. Or when we tell them their discounts are available, they're already doing.
And if I choose to do that additional training, what do I have to provide to you so that I get credit for that?
You have to just let us know. You give us a call, tell us what you're doing, we'll document it, and we don't need any documentation sent to us.
Great.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
And this is historic as far as these aren't the first sightings. I mean, there have been sightings, like you said, over the years, and we're talking a good many years, not just the recent past. And there was probably more that have been sighted by pilots that well after the fact, because they didn't want to report it at the time for the reasons you expressed that, you know, oh my gosh, you know, military pilots seeing things, they're going to put them on the ground.
Even commercial pilots. We did a previous event involving a Japan Airlines crew, and they took them off flying.
Yeah.
They had to go to the head shed and go through all sorts of evaluations before they could come back on the line.
Yeah.
So what do you think that does to reporting?
Yeah, exactly. It shuts it all down. And again, you know, now, okay, I think we've opened it up a little bit. But again, I mean, Todd, do you see that? Am I seeing what you're seeing? Are you seeing what I'm seeing? Other than by the time you finish questioning each other, whatever it was is gone. And it's like, hey, do we report this? Do we sit on it? What do we do with it?
Well, here's a thing about these events. The one thing they all have in common is the air traffic organization of the FAA. Now, as I said, there's no real official policy that I've seen either for the air traffic organization or the FAA as a whole about this. But in these two cases, there was not a suppression of what was said. It was not sanitized to the point that people like you and I aren't going to sit there and scratch our heads saying, this doesn't make any sense. Now, here's another teaser, another spoiler. I thought, okay, these are two events that happened to occur 2 hours apart. What else happened that week that was equally weird? So I went through that database. Like I said, every quarter, they have hundreds of these available. I download them. I put them into my ever-growing spreadsheet. And I thought, let me just search for any UAS, you know, drones near airport reports that are above 20,000 feet, above flight level 200. And I thought, they're not near an airport, but they're near an airplane. Okay. December 22nd, 2024, basically a day after the two of the events we talked about. The first one is near Charleston. Preliminary info, and this is in FA shorthand. Let me translate into English. A 737-800 flying from ILG to DAB. I should know what those cities are, but those are two airports.
DAB is Daytona Beach.
Okay. And I can't remember ILG. Reported a UAS from the 9 o'clock position while southwestbound at flight level 360, 20 miles west of Charleston. No evasive action taken. No law enforcement organization notification reported. And this was a report sent to what's called the Washington Operations Center. The two we talked about earlier were also sent to the Washington Operations Center, which is sort of a clearinghouse for the FAA for things that could be of interest to the National Airspace System. So this is one of the few reports from this drones near airport database that went to the Washington Operations Center. On the 23rd of December, a regional jet, I believe it was a Delta Connection Embraer 175, was going from LaGuardia to Kansas City, reported a UAS from the 12 o'clock position while westbound at flight level 320, 30 miles east of Springfield. That same night, this was a 737-800 going from O'Hare to Las Vegas, reported a possible UAS from 12 o'clock position while westbound at flight level 340 in the vicinity of Sioux City. Now, this happened in the dead of night. It would have been around 8 o'clock Central Time for Kansas City, about 9 o'clock Central Time near in Iowa. This was in December, so this is well after sunset. So how are you going to see a UAS at night over the Midwest at 30-some-odd thousand feet? It's got to be somehow or another lit up. Is it lit up with lights? Is it lit up through other means? And this is at flight level 320 and 340. Again, it doesn't make any sense to have any sort of uncrewed aircraft flying in the vicinity of a passenger airliner that late at night. These are two events where I would love to get a mandatory occurrence report, if there is one, to see what else might be reported. And there are literally dozens of these just in the year 2024 and 2025 that I've seen in this drones near airport database, which make me scratch my head. Here's a Cessna Citation Latitude going from L.A. to SSI. Can't remember what that city is. Reported to U.S. at 9 o'clock position while southeastbound at flight level 410, 35 miles west of the Harris-Tacan. No evasive action taken. Okay. Again, this is going to you, Greg. Often do you know of people seeing things that make no sense, aircraft that shouldn't be there, at these kinds of flight levels?
You know, it's obvious that at night, you look out the window, you can identify an aircraft. I mean, a conventional aircraft, like you said, with the position lights and things like that. But to have, you know, an object that, one, you don't expect, or two, typically ATC is going to give you a heads up. Hey, you got crossing traffic, you know, 1,000 below or 1,000 above, or, you know, at flight level 330, however they phrase it, they're giving you a heads up. ATC is not giving you a heads up on this for both of these flight crews. And in fact, it's reversed. It's now the flight crew going, hey, we got something up here. We're looking at, there's 25 of these things. What do you show? We show nothing. That in and of itself is scary dangerous, because we've got some sort of objects up there that are potential threats to flight safety. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know how they're operating. We don't know what direction or what maneuvers they're performing that could jeopardize the safety of a flight, whether it's a commercial flight or even a military flight.
Is my last one. Can't leave 2025 out of this. This is January 5th, 2025. There was an A350-900 going from Atlanta to Los Angeles. I believe it was a Delta airliner as well. At flight level 400, reported a silver UAS 4 feet in diameter while westbound at flight level 400, 15 miles northeast of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Okay, first off, you're cruising along an airliner at, I don't know, 400 miles an hour, whatever it is. How close does something have to be before you can guesstimate that it's 4 feet in diameter?
Oh, I mean, that had to be really close if it's 4 feet. One, unless it's flying formation with you, Todd, because again, look, I mean, you have something coming at you. We'll just call it two airliners. You know, they're both doing 500 knots in opposite directions. That's a thousand knots closing speed. Stuff's happening like right now, real quick. And I mean, when it is the size of a 777 passing under you at 1,000 feet, but doing 500, you do have time to see its size. If they can say that it's 4 feet, that thing is, I mean, it's either flying formation right outside the window or it passed so damn close. I just don't understand. I mean, because humans can process information pretty quick, the brain can, but not that quick. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the time you see this thing, you go, what the hell is that?
Now, one question I have to ask about this. like you said, what the heck is that? They say it's a UAS. Okay. It's at 40,000 feet. What UAS do you know? What drone do you know of that can operate at 40,000 feet with propellers? So it's probably with some sort of, you know, jet powered, whatever. It's 4 feet in diameter. It's pretty small for a jet. And it was at 9:23 in the morning Central Time. So it's daytime. So you say it's a balloon. Okay, let's say it was a balloon. Then why is it there's a notation in this one that says Washington Operations Center? WOC is the acronym. It's like, if it was a balloon, why would it be taken to the head shed for further evaluation? Inquiring minds would like to know.
I mean, we've had runaway weather balloons. I mean, they get reported. We've had nefarious balloons that drifted from China, you know, that we've gone after and stuff. But again, none of those had lights on them. So, I mean, because the last thing you want to do is draw attention to it. So, I mean, for them to say that, okay, you got a red and white light, okay, that's non-standard for any kind of aircraft that we know of. And why would, well, then the other question is, well, why would somebody, a visitor from another world, if you will, why would they care whether you got red and white lights on it? What do those red and white lights do? Is that how they propel their particular vehicle or object or whatever? And those lights are just a byproduct of whatever it is they're converting into some level of thrust or some type of thrust to propel that thing through the atmosphere. Who knows? Again, you've got 25 of these things. You got four pilots who report the same thing, and then others who have reported size. I mean, hell, that thing had to be really close if you can say that that was 4 feet in, you know, in diameter. I mean, think about it. That's the size of a small kitchen, round kitchen table.
It would probably be less weird if they said they saw a kitchen table at 40,000 feet.
Well, Todd, I can get a 2x4 to fly if it goes fast enough. So,
well, you know, one of the problems I had with this whole issue, if UAP are going to be considered an aviation safety issue, then you have to have, in my opinion, some data to work with. But on the other hand, it's a chicken or egg thing. If you don't have definitions, if you don't have a structure in place, if you don't have an acceptability of this as a reality, what kind of data are you going to have? And I thought one of the best kinds of data we'll have is something that is identified as something else, because it's A, the closest thing they can come up with, and B, if you identify it as that one thing, it might be tracked and codified through existing systems, which is why I've been looking at the FAA drone sightings near airports database and NASA's aviation safety reporting system, both of which, in my opinion, have UAP type events in them, but they're called something else.
Do we know, is there a world database? I can't imagine that we're the only country that has this phenomena happening. I mean, are they happening over Russia, Siberia, freaking, you know, Europe or wherever? I mean, are other pilots in other parts of the world reporting these kinds of phenomena?
Well, in fact, one of the reasons I started studying this a few years ago, because 15 years ago, there was an author named Leslie Kane, who I happened to interview back in 2013, who wrote a book about, back then there were UFOs, not UAPs. Basically, she looked at government documents from around the world, U.S., Iran, France, etc., and basically said, look, this has been studied or cited or whatever around the world. So that's one of the pieces of information that says to me, this is a global phenomenon. We all have probably heard at some point or another about the Foo Fighters of World War II, where both the Axis and the Allies were seeing these at night, and they thought it was the other side that had a secret weapon. You know, balls of light that would follow along with bomber formations, play around with them, and then zoom off again. The Foo Fighters never attacked them, never shot them down, at least to our knowledge, but they remain a mystery to this day. And in fact, this event with the Delta airliner sounds like a Foo Fighter event. They're flying along. These lights are playing with them, flying in formation. They fool around for a while, then they fly away, much like the stories from World War II. So it's not only something that's global, it's something that, in my opinion, has been happening for decades. But it brings me back to the question, what the heck are these things? Yeah. Are these conventional things we're misidentifying? are these unconventional things, but made by human hands? Is it a natural phenomenon that we just don't understand? Is it none of the above? Is it all the above? Yeah.
Well, the other question I have is, with all the highest levels of sophistication that not only our military, but other militaries use, why isn't the military picking any of this stuff up? Why aren't any of our, quote, spy satellites picking any of this stuff up with all of the highest levels of technology?
Well, having had a very short career in the intelligence community, there could be all sorts of assets and platforms out there that are picking things up that never become part of the public database simply because it's a potential national security issue, or it's just an unknown that, you know, they would like to identify. And bureaucracies being what they are, you got some fantastic stuff sitting in file cabinets or in servers somewhere, but there's just no way to get them out. You know, what we have here with the FAA and NASA are one of the few things that exist in the U.S. government that I'm aware of that is both accessible to the public and is systematic and has things that allow us to at least ask these questions, if not answer them.
The thing that always jumps out at me, John, is the fact that we, the United States, can't keep a secret.
That's for sure.
We suck at that. I mean, you know, there is stuff getting leaked all the time for whoever's personal gain or whatever. And if we do have a repository of data or at least information about these, whatever they are, I would have expected that something would have leaked out. I mean, look, I mean, I know stuff's leaking out about, you know, the John F. Kennedy Jr. assassination or Area 51 and things like that. Well after the fact, but we are well after the initial fact when these things first started, you know, becoming an issue or at least a reportable phenomenon. I'm just surprised that more information hasn't been leaked that could lend some credibility. I mean, look, I can't remember if it was CBS 60 Minutes or one of those shows where they interviewed a bunch of military pilots who had reported these sightings. And while there were interesting stories, what was the end game with all of that? What's the end game today?
On the leak part of it, there's leaking, and then there's, you know, scratching the surface until you find something. And in the case of these two events, it was the latter. You know, I first became aware of it because the one public report, the drones near airports database, and I thought, well, gee, they only give a very bare-bone sketch. They said it was a 767-400. It was this date, this time, roughly this location. It's like, what if I can get a tail number? I didn't go to the government for that. I went to Flight Radar 24, Flight Aware, ADS-B Exchange. These are public access points where you can figure out, if you have enough information, you can zero in on the aircraft, who flew it, what the flight number was. With that information, I then went to a previously existing system, the Freedom of Information Act, and said, hey, FAA, you have anything on this aircraft at this altitude, at this time, in this location? They gave me two pieces of data, the mandatory occurrence reports. And I'm thinking, these MORs are a great piece of information. Can I get these publicly from an online database? No. However, I can go back to those first two resources, like your flight radar, EDSB type places, plus FOIA, and get those. So the ones I mentioned today on the show, I will be putting in a FOIA request for those particular events. And so my friends at the FAA, please, my request this time would be a lot more focused, a lot shorter. So please don't take 6 months.
I just put in an FOI request on a case that I happened to be working, and I had to call other people that I work with because I put that request in, and normally these requests take months, like you were talking about, Todd, or they fall into the abyss and a year later they're still in process. I put in a FOI request July 15th. It was fulfilled with 276 pages of documents and sent to me on July 24th. It is historic that somebody turned it around that quickly at the FAA, but I greatly appreciate that timeliness because I was expecting to wait months and all I had to do was wait days.
Now, two pieces of information I came across on the internet. One was a database of every FOIA report sent to the FAA, thousands of them. I downloaded the whole thing because I want to learn from my betters, right? If somebody if I hear that somebody has a 2-week turnaround, it's like, which requests have they made? How were those requests worded? Let me word it in the same way.
Yeah.
And also another thing I came across, which you internet sleuths out there, you can do the same thing. I don't know how I stumbled across it. It was like a list of thousands and thousands of phone numbers and email addresses for FAA employees.
Yes, I've seen that one as well, yes.
That is in a prominent place on my hard drive. And yeah. I have to dial up a few people.
Yep, I've got that as well.
And a generous donation to Flight Safety the Detectives, we will send you that list.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you know, we're not shameless, so... But, well, I think it's an interesting discussion. I think, you doing as much digging as you've been doing, and I know you'll continue to do, will be of interest to our audience because while, yes, there are internet programs, discussions, podcasts about these UAPs, there's TV shows and everything else, I think we're all interested in at least for it, trying to understand, one, what they may be, but two, how they may jeopardize safety of those aircraft that not only we utilize, but are utilized worldwide, how these objects of whatever they are pose a threat to flight safety for those of us in the air.
And my second to last word is sort of like a word we've been saying or phrases we've said repeatedly. What the heck is going on?
I like that. That's very short and succinct, Todd. Thank you very much. So with that very short second to the last word, John, we're going to leave you with our last word and see if you can make it even shorter.
No, I can't because, I still want to protect the people flying. The general aviation community, who we have many friends. We just talked to many, many, many of them out in Oshkosh. So if you're going to go flying, you need to pre-plan. Do it at home. Do it at the airport. Make sure it all agrees. If it doesn't, do it all over again. And get out to the airplane pre-flights. We still get emails from people that find things on pre-flights. And some of them finding things right after somebody else had done a pre-flight. So it really is, you have to be observant. Make sure you look at your flight controls, the attachment points. Look for that cotter pin. If it's got a castellated nut, when you get back in the airplane and get yourself up in the air, put that head on a swivel. And let's not have a mid-air. Don't get involved in somebody else's mess. And just as an aside, I've been going through a bunch of accident reports that come up and incident reports that come up. I can't believe the number of people that taxi their general aviation airplanes into fuel pumps and into fences.
I know. I know.
I mean, it's like three of them inside of a month.
Yep.
It just talk about where's their attention span?
Well, John, a lot of this is heads down. Why? Because everybody's got an iPad on their lap. They're using ForeFlight or one of the other internet programs, and they've got their head down trying to figure out either following a taxi chart on their iPad, or they're already planning for when they're in the air and not paying attention to where they're going on the ground. I see it all the time. I got guys, I don't know how many times I've been cut off coming out of the ramp by a taxiing airplane with a flight instructor on board. And I can see that both pilots are looking down as they're taxiing. And it's just, it is what it is. And, again, You got two people in that airplane. Somebody's got to fly the airplane on the ground. That is, you got to have your head out the window. You got to be seeing what's out there. You got to keep the airplane under control. You can't both be heads down. I don't care if it's an instruction flight. Instructors should know that you're not giving guidance or counsel or instruction so that both of your heads are down when you're looking at something, especially when you're taxiing around a busy airport or an airport that has other aircraft movements going on. You cannot do that because you're going to find yourself in a place you don't want to be.
So I'm going to start collecting a couple of those stupid accidents, I'll call
yeah.
them. And so we'll talk about them one day.
Yep.
You know?
Good. So with that, I will end it with fly safe.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
According to Avemco claims data, 34% of aircraft accidents happen on landing. Does this number surprise you? Avemco Insurance Company values safety and believes strongly in continuous pilot training and education to help prevent these accidents and promote safer skies for everyone. That's why they sponsor the Fast Team Wings program and the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Avemco rewards safer pilots with premium credits through their Safety Rewards program. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're one of our listeners. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety.